Hello, everybody. This is Tom Lynn here, and I am joined this evening by Brett. Say your last name, Brett. I don't want to risk messing it up.
That's just
So,
Bernhoff. T silent.
okay, Brett Birdhoff and Brett here. For those of you who have followed me, you will be aware that I stand in a relationship of tension with lots of the technological developments of our time. Brett, on the other hand, has a kind of comfort with that domain. And so he's been kind enough to come on and provide a voice for a differential perspective from those which we have been entertaining most recently. And beginning from sort of the concrete aspect of how he's more involved in that world of the technological, of technique, of the digital, and so forth, we can look at some of the projects with which he's involved, and just enlisting those projects will, I think, bring to light some of the issues at hand here. So, what are some of those projects, Brett, with which you are involved as an organizer or in other capacities?
Sure. I volunteer with a wiki online called the H Plus Pedia Wiki. It's transhumanism. It's a transhumanist wiki, and its goal is to just hold space for that kind of information, supportive information of transhumanism. And then kind of to the side of that, and connected to YouTube in a lot of ways, are my organizer roles with meetup.com. I organize two meetups. One is the Global Technomancer Guild, and the other is the Portland Web Development Club. And both of those are, one of those is brand new, and the other one has been around for a few years, but they're areas of my life that I'm very passionate about. And I'm thankful I can be an organizer for those kinds of things.
So to begin, I suppose, with the transhumanism, that segment of the conversation, as it were, H plus Pedia, a wiki for information around transhumanism. Now, under the umbrella of that term or that orientation, there's a range of possibilities in terms of what people intend or mean by it. On the extreme end, there are people who are evidently comfortable with leaving humanity behind and moving into becoming purely technological digital beings. This is the impression that I have. I'm subject to correction. Not everyone goes all the way with that, right? Some people see it more as an attitude of enhancement where you modify the biological substrate of the human being so as to allegedly enhance their engagement with the world. And I mean, I suppose the mild, I mean, that, so, but how do you understand transhumanism and where do you see it yourself with reference to, the range within of possibilities in terms of what that term represents?
Sure. I view transhumanism, simply put, I view transhumanism as the use of technology to elevate the human condition out of some sort of poverty. Not that the human condition is povertous, if that's a word, but there are forms of poverty that many humans find themselves within. And I find and feel and understand technology to be a set of tools that can help almost anyone, if not everyone, elevate themselves out of situations they would rather not be within, or to better health, better intelligence, and better well-being, as the three supers go: super wellness, super intelligence, and super well-being. But I define technology or transhumanism as simply being the application of technology to elevate the human condition.
Okay, so I find that that's a rather mild a sort of tact as far as transhumanism goes, and maybe in part that's because I'm attached to the implications of the prefix trans regarding the movement. And, you know, its exponents, people like Nick Bostrom and so forth, right? Where, or, you know, they're all the parade examples, very Kurzweil and friends, okay? So these people seem to be interested in advancing not an elevation of the human condition, but an actual ontological modification. And you know, you don't seem to be taking that tack. You are defining it as the application of technology to remedy certain kinds of lack.
That is correct.
Now, there's material lack, but I don't know if that really is involved in sorts of, so that doesn't seem particularly controversial, the idea of, at least at first approximation. Okay, you do actually. Run into issues even on that level, especially if you consider a kind of, you can take a Marxian tact and note how under the dispensation of capital, technology is driven by the forces of capital to develop along certain lines, which while superficially giving rise to a circumstance of overproduction, simultaneously creates a contradiction where the conditions of that overproduction end up impoverishing the population at large vis-a-vis the mechanism of wage labor. Or you can take an Ellulean tack, Jacques Ellul, and this is maybe like the more severe challenge to your position, where the claim is that the French word is la technique, or you can talk about the technique, which he is distinguishing from technology. Technique is the ensemble of technologies which are coordinated with an eye to the maximally efficient dispensation of such problems as arise. So then even with respect to the address of material conditionality, there's a kind of Faustian bargain being struck. Because the what Ellul and others will argue is that the use of technique actually redounds upon the human and begins to modify the human in a way which ultimately can subvert and even perhaps ultimately destroy the human essence. And this is the sort of the cyborg problem, if you like. But these issues can be raised. I'm sorry, I'm talking an awful lot. I'm going to turn it over to you here in just a second, just to round up the point as quickly as possible. These issues can be raised in connection with the address of material poverty, but then you have the issues which become maybe more difficult emotionally and so forth of these other matters. So what was the, so you enumerated sort of like a trilogy, right? You said, what was it? Super
intelligence, super well-being, and super longevity.
Okay, so intelligence, well-being, longevity.
Typical transhuman focuses.
So immediately with intelligence, okay, this is like challenging to me, because I feel that already there's what does one mean by intelligence? Let's begin there. What is intelligence actually?
That's a great question. There are many forms of intelligence, as I think most would understand. There are many minds and dispositions, but for the sake of this conversation, let's just call it solving problems. And that can be intuitive, that can be logical, rational. Intelligence is just basically the ability to solve challenges in one's life. And for this conversation, I think that would do. creatively, perhaps solve creatively solve problems, not through a rule book or a set of conditions, but the ability to come up with your own solution for a problem. And there's a lot that goes into that, but I think that that's, there's some, I think that that's a marker of sentience to a degree. I think that's a marker of willpower and individuality, and or just a membership of a certain caste or species in certain contexts. There could be different species that can solve problems, not just humans. That's been shown. That's easy. But the ability to solve a problem creatively, I think, is a good definition.
It's interesting that you highlight the terms of sentience and willpower. Because the concern that I have is that the increasing deployment of technology, especially digital technologies, very actively erodes our capacity to exercise, to abide in our own sentience, to exercise our willpower. And I will add, insofar as a kind of attentivity or attention is involved in the engagement of a problem and its resolution, I see an additional manner in which these technologies and the interfaces through which they're accessed actually diminish our human potentiality. So in this respect, I think that transhumanism is faced with a very pointed challenge. So how do you address those concerns?
That's an interesting.
I mean, maybe if you need me to clarify why I feel that way, I'm happy to do so.
That would be great. Sure.
I mean, in terms of like the erosion of sentience, in sentience, like consciousness and awareness is one of those words that it's difficult to pin down. It's at the border line. It's in the borderlands of what can be conveyed discursively. You almost have to rely on a poetical voice to point in that direction. So that being admitted, and so we're going to have the faith that we can exist within a colloquial understanding of what it is to be sentient, to be aware, at least as a point of departure. The manner in which these devices tend to operate, whether you're talking about your phone or for an extended interval in front of a laptop, or even before you proceed to exactly digital technologies, if you look at a factory framework and the strictures of automation, you have in all these cases a kind of hypnosis of the human. They become hypnotized and engaged and are invited to become almost automated in their relationship with what's going on, whether that be vis-a-vis like some kind of entertainment where you become just sort of glued to the television, or you're scrolling constantly, or you know, you're on an assembly line and you become so locked into performing a just highly specific task that the need to actually be conscious dissipates. It's almost like it lulls you into a kind of a sleep. It can even lull you into a literal sleep. This is connected intimately with problems of attention and sustained attention. Again, all these technologies, see, and the way in which they compel us to relate with information. So what is it to like read something on the internet and you're reading, you're like, oh, here's a link, and that takes you there, takes you there, and takes you there. So then you have to circle back to the text, but there's a kind of fragmentation to the process. There's a fragmentation to the process which complicates and interferes in our ability to stay present to what is being voiced by the text in question. And then in terms of willpower, because all these things diminish our attentivity and lead us into a kind of automation, it actually leads to an atrophy of active decisionality. So these are all various mechanisms whereby these frames of technology act to impair our intelligence, if intelligence is the creative and sentient engagement and resolution of problems as they arise. So that I mean, does that clarify where the grounds of my apprehension arise, or from the grounds?
Sorry, go ahead. I keep cutting you off. My apologies.
No. So I'm asking then, like, how do you personally respond or feel about those objections, concerns?
I would say that they're timeless. They've been the ancient Greek mythologies talked about. I think it was Hephaestus, the armor or the.
Right, the sort of smith of the gods, as it were.
Precisely, and he had a withered arm, if I'm not mistaken. He had some atrophy because he was a technology maker, and that was the relationship between his body and his products was an atrophy, and that is common, is that technology can atrophy the human muscle of some sort, physical, mental, spiritual. I think that. In my experience with technology, it takes the decision to master the technology to then use it as the tool it's intended to be used. And we're not even necessarily master the technology. It just means become familiar with it. And by doing so, and by on a side note, kind of developing your own sense of self and developing your own sense of autonomy and true will and desire, you put those two together, you put in a familiarization with technology and a desire to apply your will through it, and you have the beginnings of some very major changes in your life, if that's the way one goes. And at least that's been my experience. Just when I started coding about 7 years ago, I was not very familiar with technology. I wanted to be, but I was not. And now 7 years later, I'm definitely not the best in the world, but I'm capable of using technology in some pretty interesting ways, we could say. And through that capacity, aligned with another life that I've led, not a different lifetime, but different lifestyle that I've led during this lifetime, I feel that I've put together a strong will and a strong understanding of technology and a desire and earnestness to make something from that. And through that, just like any other tool, that desire, that will, that and that movement of energy or intention through the technology will create change. And with these digital tools, especially on the internet, it makes massive change very quickly. If you're doing that intentionally, especially. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. So what I hear you saying is that the challenges which I've addressed can be addressed through the exercise of individual commitment to relate to the tool in a particular way or set of ways. And that this, and also you are saying that the concerns that I raise are in part perennial, that this always arises in connection with any sort of technological development, certainly arises with the emergence of written script, whether that goes as far back as, hieroglyphs and so forth and so forth. Where the notation was that you would have an impairment of memory and so forth. And indeed, you did actually see an impairment of memory and really a transformation of our relationship with memory from what it was in antiquity. The claim then, I guess, implicit in my concerns was that these contemporary technologies are in some way qualitatively distinct from their antecedents, with regard to what they are inviting us to do. And it's incumbent upon me to clarify what the distinction may be. Here, I'm disposed to lean on the analysis of Ivan Illich, perhaps first in his book, Tools for Conviviality, where he distinguishes between convivial tools and industrial tools. And loosely put, a convivial tool is characterized by its capacity to expand, enhance the autonomy of the individual and the capacity of that individual to exist in a spontaneous convivial relationship with others in his world and his world itself. Contrast to that, he loosely calls industrial tools, and industrial tools, rather than fostering autonomy, actually foster a radical kind of dependence. An example here might be the automobile, which example I choose because doesn't it seem to, in fact, enhance the autonomy of the individual to have an automobile and expand their ability to traverse their landscape at great speeds and so forth? And then there's a kind of force to that suggestion. But then it is met by the broader sort of set of infrastructural concerns, which are linked to the availability of the automobile. And so then you have this radical change in the structuring of cities and the land to create the roads. And you have this investiture and then extraction from the earth of petrochemicals and so forth. And then paradoxically, this machine, which is supposed to give us greater freedom, actually narrows the range of possibilities. And not just in terms of the infrastructure through which it ties us, but then you can even look at the financing and how having to have a car itself creates financial exigencies. It ties you into a system and gets, you know, it impairs your identity as a mere pedestrian. And so that means that rather than being convivial, the automobile is an industrial tool. Now, but interestingly, at the same moment as Illich critiques the automobile, he notes that the telephone system is fundamentally convivial. And the reason he says it's convivial is because it's something that you can leave or take. Anybody can use it. You know, it's almost structurally democratic or nearly democratic, right? Telephony and so forth, right? And there's a seduction there. Yeah. And if you like broaden the sense of what is meant by the technological to the organizational, you can look at the postal service and things like that. Then we shift to the internet and say, well, what's the difference between the internet and telephony? And what I would contend is that the fundamental difference is that the internet mediates our experience in a fundamentally different way than a telephone or a correspondence letter. Because the demands of putting something into a format which is amenable to digital conveyance, and actually, in my mind, will transform whatever it is you're trying to communicate in usually a deleterious manner. Thank you for your patience here. I will grant that there's a space between from where you're coming and from where I'm coming, where you see it seems like some kind of detente may be realized, because I'm not wanting to represent a sort of Luddite positionality. To go back just a step to what I just said before about how I feel that reframing things so that they're amenable to digital conveyance mutates or impairs them. What I'm getting at on a fundamental level is that as far as I can tell, the digital demands us to approach the world in binary terms and possibly in turn invites us to see outcomes as merely what can be determined through a probabilistic or stochastic lens. And so this is, to me, the real issue. I don't think reality is binary. And I think probabilistic lenses also interfere with our experience in a different way, but let's bracket that for the moment, just because I've been going on and I want to give you a chance to respond. So it's not this movement or the binary that I think is impairing us. What do you think?
That's a fascinating comparison. That's an interesting observation in the sense of, for instance, duality, the yes, the no, the hot, the cold. The spectrum is ignored in binary, as you're, I think, implying. And
yes, I mean, structurally ignored, right? That's even like, it's almost like a kind of mathematical necessity. At least that was the, from my understanding of early information theory and so forth. You have to sort of rely on a kind of destructuring of continual processes to give to allow them to realize a mathematically amenable articulation. And so it's sort of similar to a calculus. You're trying to find the area under the curve. You can, there's the method where you like, instead of trying to find the whole area, you break it up successively into different segments, and then you try and expand the terms of division and asymptotically approach that moment when this process of disintegration merges with the whole of the field under the integral. Well, that destructuring is a part of an abstraction, and I guess I'm making a claim, a rather dramatic claim, that without being in the aware of what's actually happening in terms of how we're using this method to relate to reality, you actually run the risk of actually severing your relationship with the real. This is the problem that originates in modernity. You know, and Husserl puts it in terms of Galileo and the Galilean mathematization of nature. But we can become detained by that mathematization, and digital technology instantiates that tendency. Gosh, I'm talking too much here, man. You gotta. Let me just quiet myself and let you just sort of riff for a minute.
All right.
Because I don't want to. I'm talking more than you, and I'm not trying to dominate the conversation. I apologize for being a bit of a blatherskite.
So totally fine. It's totally fine. This is a conversation, so we're going back and forth. I think it's just fine. In terms of, I think what you said about disconnecting from reality is a very important observation to make, because how many video games now are having to put text that says you should go outside and stop playing so much because you are disconnected from reality? You'll find those in video games these days, where sometimes between loading screens, they'll have a little text that says you should go outside, because they are, the assumption is that the player is disconnected from reality. The player is isolated in an environment that's probably their bedroom or their apartment or somewhere away from people, et cetera, nature, and becoming kind of monocultured in some senses. I feel that's a legitimate critique of digital technologies, because digital technologies are in some senses quite primitive to what we could have. We could have coding languages that don't use zeros and ones. We could have programming philosophies that don't rely on true or false. We could use that spectrum of reality in our coding or in our machines and create better machines. I feel that what we have today is rather, we've inherited the last 80 years of computer programming science to what we have for today. And through that, it was binary. It was machine code. It was zeros and ones and dots. And today we have the capacity to create a renaissance in how machines think and how machines operate.
How is that concretely? Tell me what you mean by that. A few things come up for me as you say that, but I'm going to hold off on those things. What do you mean in terms of moving beyond the binary as the ground of programming?
All right, that's a fair question. I've seen videos put up by DARPA that on YouTube, just mainstream simple DARPA videos that they want the public to see, where they're talking about different modalities of coding using different using the structure of chemistry to create. Instead of 1, 0, A through Z as possible combinations, because right now we're using ones and zeros for everything. We live in as you're aware, we live in a vast field, sea of zeros and ones. It's an ocean, endlessly deep of zeros and ones today. But we could use the structure of chemistry as an example to model different kinds of programming. And those kinds of programming would create different kinds of computers, and different kinds of computers would create different kinds of relationships to those machines. We are currently stuck in 1940, 1950 with our technical thinking. And that's not to say that it's wrong necessarily or that it's right necessarily. It's just to say that we've inherited some very old school thoughts. And there are movements underway now, as a simple example, that DARPA video that I mentioned, I could share a link with you later if you'd like me to transform the very nature of how machines operate at the system, at the code level, at the hardware level. So it's about changing the philosophies and assumptions of programming itself, how it operates, how the programmer's mind operates, what's expected. And I've heard it said by a I'll make this my last point.
No, you're fine. I'm just it's really fascinating to hear the language. To me is a very important segment of the debate, but please finish your point.
All right. I have heard from a lifelong programmer, someone who started in his 20s and retired in his 60s or 70s, that we have made dramatic increases and improvements to the hardware and the performance of our computers, but we still use the same coding structures we used in 1960, 1950, when AI was first dreamed up, when we had the idea of thinking computers first emerge in our culture or in our world. At least in the modern world, quote unquote. And that if we were to change the software, the wetware, the programming, the instructions, we could change the way the computers operate. And it's like the DNA of the computer being changed in some way, or just a new generation of computers altogether.
Well, the first thing I might say is that I'm going to resist the characterization that this foundation in the movements of the 40s and 50s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, that it is somehow nigh obsolete or is old or antiquated. I think what was unfolded in those decades was something deeply related to the structure of the process that math, despite my apprehensions about abstraction, mathematical realities are, in my view, expressive of certain ontic and ontological structures. So the great appeal of the binary format and the manner in which it's deployed by people like Claude Shannon and so forth, and Turing and those cats, is that it's fixing on a node of interface between the facet of our reality and some of the structures which are mathematically germane. Your coding, in some respects, as I understand it, is really just an exposition of what can be attained through the application of mathematical logic, and I'm using the term mathematical logic technically here, not as a sort of like a general gloss, right? to various problems which arise, right? So it's not that you can actually change those foundations, because those foundations are grounded in the true, in the real, in a manner that to me seems permanent, right? There's no new foundation, because you're talking about trying to subvert an axiomatic ground, right? I think that you can maybe come up with new techniques and so forth that create sort of innovations, but you're not going to fundamentally transform the nature of the coding process insofar as it relies on a certain mathematical strategies, because these mathematical strategies are part of the structure of being itself. So I'm going to resist this. I'm sorry, I hate to be contrarian, right? But I have to resist this notion that we can just find a new strategy of coding, because it seems that it's inexorable with what you're dealing. It's inexorable as 2 + 2 = 4, the Pythagorean theorem, right? The fundamental theorem of calculus. These touch ahistorical realities. I just have to say, I shouldn't say I have to say, but I will also point out that DARPA is, well, this is an ad hominem if it's taken too seriously, right? But they're a vile organization committed to promulgating technologies that want to do harm to other people. So nothing that comes out of DARPA can be trusted. Their commitments by their very nature make them untrustworthy. All right. So just as a public service announcement, I'm going to say that DARPA, as the R&D wing of the military industrial complex, is not your friend. All right. But abstracting from whoever DARPA, you know, the who's of DARPA, right? You have this suggestion of, it's not, instead of relying on a binary code, you know, trinary, quaternary, you know, other codes are more complicated and are supposed to sort of reflect appeals to underlying biochemical structures. You know, you're still not getting out of the math, okay? You might be able to do a little bit more. What you've run up against there problematically, and this is, I think, maybe like a conservation of the matter and energy issue here, is computationally, the reason binary processing is so appealing is because it's fundamentally efficient. If you start appending further terms, which is what they're discussing, you're going to exponentially expand the load energetically for computational output. And that expansion of energetic load creates a new set of problems that are going to get in the way of these alternative technologies they talk about. Now, what they're really trying to do is say, you know, we're going to just try and harness life itself. And they mean that quite literally, all right? And they're trying to bootstrap biological processes to make them serve their own imperatives. It's a project of enslavement, is what it is. Just to be outrageously bold about it. And so when they talk about biological machines, they're talking about a vision that to me is antithetical with mere human decency. I mean, I know that's probably, you know, I mean, so there, that's my take. Now, there is one other point which I will raise, but I'll wait and give you a chance to respond to what I've said so far.
All right. I have studied some of the history of DARPA. I understand the controversies surrounding DARPA in the modern world.
Right. That's not so much a comment that was intended for you, by the way, but for my audience, right? I know you know who DARPA is, right? But go on.
No worries. I would say that the ARPA that was the former prior to DARPA, ARPA, if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong about this. In my understanding of the history of ARPA created the internet. ARPA.
That's my understanding as well. Yeah.
I've read a book. There's a book. There's a book called Where Wizards Stay Up Late. It's the book. It's a book about the history of the internet, and I love the book. I've read it a couple of times. Where Wizards Stay Up Late, and it's a book about ARPA. It's a book about the early internet and the motivations for creating it and the people behind it. My point for even bringing up that book or any of that at all is to say that maybe there certainly was a culture change at ARPA or DARPA when it became a truly military institution. There was I'll say this maybe out of ignorance, and I might be wrong about this, but from my understanding of early ARPA, there was an entirely different culture there. It was it was federally funded, and it was communicating with the military, but there was a culture of the small guy, the real innovators, the people who are capable of making genius changes to the world, such as the internet. And those comments aside, it's to say that maybe what was once ARPA no longer is, and what came out of that ARPA might have been something completely different, which if true would explain a lot of the resistance to the internet, in my opinion, just in general, because it is something that came out of an institution that no longer exists.
Well, you have a more charitable reading than I do, but again, you know, this is something which could be subject to future research. My impression is that from the beginning, the projects that were hatched by ARPA were connected with developing projects of counterinsurgency. They were from the outset connected to the imperatives of military and intelligence concern. Here, intelligence in the sense of espionage. And ultimately, they were designed to be technologies of control and surveillance. My understanding is that goes all the way back. And, you know, it's born out of the Cold War, the end of World War II, Cold War, then also concerns with revolutions in the Third World and how to deal with that and all this stuff, right? So, and it's also connected, you see, these are deep sort of like philosophical problems. At the outset, that a lot of the initial framing, you have people like John Nash and game theory, and you have a commitment to behaviorism and these very, very dark senses of what human beings are, that human beings need to be controlled. But probably the truth is somewhere in the middle. You know, I was talking with a guy who's very interested in cybernetics and makes the distinction between early cybernetics and the emergence of AI, artificial intelligence. There was a sort of thing of a breakage there. And it reflects a set of concerns of philosophical controversy at the beginning of these developments, right? So I can't pretend to know well enough to answer things definitively one way or the other. And let's not get too wrapped up in the DARPA thing, right? But it's more important are the deeper sort of conceptual issues at hand. You know, I think that the appeal to biological machines is disgusting from the beginning, because you're talking about subjecting life, living entities, which should be given their own freedom, to a logic of subjugation and domestication. And I'm not okay with that. And I don't think any of us should be. And by the way, that actually, in my view, redounds on the relationship with who we are. And you even had, sorry, when I said, by the way, earlier, this is the point I was bracketing about how the language is so important. You had this sort of like phrase, like, you know, and how the mind of the programmer relates with the machine. It's like, well, you know what? The programmer should be able to do whatever they want with their mind, and to hell with the machine. But if they're trying to design the machine to influence the mind of the programmer, then you have to ask, who is in control here? And that brings us back to the Illichian distinction between a convivial and an industrial or oppressive tool.
It's fascinating.
All right. So we've been talking for a bit. I want to give you an opportunity to bring other things into the fold, okay? So please feel free to say anything else to build off what I just said. But I was going to ask maybe if you wanted to pivot to this other project of yours around technomancy and the intersection of the magical and the technological.
Absolutely. I appreciate that pivot. That's a good time for that. And I would say that my interest in technology and technomancy, technopaganism, stems about 5-6 years ago. I read a book by Eric Davis called Technosis. And that book, it wasn't a revelatory book. It wasn't instant enlightenment, but it opened my eyes to the thinking about mysticism, technology and information. I think the subtitle of Technosis is Information in the Age, Myth and Mysticism in the Age of Information, or something to that extent. And the implication is that technology, even though you might say most magicians don't use technology in their practices for one reason or another, it's to say that technology, in my eyes, is no different than nature. We are part of nature, and what we create is also part of nature. That's just my opinion. But I will say that through that philosophy, through my comfort and my appeal to technology, I have been able to create change in my mind and my life that I would never have been able. I don't assume I would have been able to do otherwise.
Without asking you to become like too personal.
Oh, okay.
Do you have like an example, a concrete example, or you don't have to like, or you can just make an example if you don't want to talk about anything personally as to what you mean concretely, where technology has facilitated some sort of growth in your person.
Definitely.
If that's what you mean.
It is what I mean, and I appreciate the question. I would say that my coding education brought me out of poverty into a normal life, I guess you could say, into the mainstream. I was living without much resource at all, and it took me 5 years to learn to code. And when I did learn to code and I got my first programmer job, it opened my life to normalcy. It just opened my life to, I can go buy groceries now, and I can buy that DVD of that movie I want, and I can do all sorts of normal human things. Whereas before, I just didn't have any skills. I didn't have any employability besides maybe $10 an hour in my community, because that's all there really is out here in this part of the country. But with technology, I was able to open a remote lifestyle, and I've been able to access the entire world with my knowledge of technology and my practice of magic and mysticism, I guess you could say, just spirituality and technology. Has opened that remote lifestyle to me in ways that have absolutely transformed my thinking, and I've been able to travel the world because of my remote lifestyle. I've been able to start communities.
Okay. You mean when you say you've been able to travel the world, you mean you've actually been able to travel? You don't mean that you're talking with someone on the internet in Shanghai. You mean you've gotten on an airplane or on a boat or something, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes,
sorry, I just wanted to clarify.
No, it's cool. I physically traveled the world for a number of months, Western Hemisphere of the planet, and I had to say it changed my life. So,
I believe you. I believe you, and I don't want to be challenging in terms of that process. Well, let me ask you then, what do you understand by, that is a trade that you learn. You learn coding as a trade, but there are other trades. You could have become a carpenter, for example, or a welder or an electrician. The trades have been sort of left in, ill repute by the dominant culture, but these are other approaches to the task of making a living. That kind of opens up in a whole different direction with reference to our relationship with work. But let me ask you this What do you mean by your practice of magic, right? You know.
That's a great question. Let's assume that the human will, the individual or collective human will, has the capacity to make change happen, and that that will is the most important, the intention and that will are the most important ingredients in anything happening in life, you could say, besides the energy to actually erupt the event. Through the application of my will and my skills, I've pushed change into the world that I have seen create in my life. Just it's a 180 degree change. But in the world at large, I've seen it change other people's lives minorly. I've created change. It's essentially the pushing of human will and energy onto the internet or through technology to create change in the world, and that is. Just that is as old as Aleister Crowley. Not that his definition of reality is the best, but it's and just
the project. Let's just talk about magic,
sure,
for a moment, okay. And we don't have to lean on Crowley. He's kind of a dubious figure in any event. All right, magic is ancient. It's part of human civilization, and so your understanding of magic is the application of human will to compel the realization of an intent as manifest in the physical domain.
I would say that's a pretty good definition of what I'm saying, yes.
And what distinguishes it as specifically magical is that the process of that unfolding of that manifestation will resist a reductive explanation. To borrow a phrase from sort of the discourse of Neville Goddard, right? Magic will affect a bridge of events that will lead you to the end sought, but in a manner which is utterly beyond anticipation and understand it.
Beautiful definition of magic. Yes, that's a beautiful definition of magic. And synchronicity might be a great word to use at this moment. Those synchronicities that connect us to different things seems to be a pretty common theme in much of magic.
Well, the synchronous, by the way, follows. It doesn't proceed, or it doesn't precede, right? So that's the concern. You don't want to follow the signs. You should allow the signs to follow you. Otherwise, you will be caught in the net of your own spell somewhat recursively. So putting my cards on the table, I consider the magical to be eminently a facet of our world, of our reality. And thus, you know, technology to me, well, they say like the really good technology is indistinguishable from magic, right? But let me just inflect in that characterization. I can't remember who said that. I want to say it might have been Arthur C. Clarke. Was it Arthur C. Clarke? I think it was Arthur C. Clarke, but I could be wrong about that. But what's to be noted about that proposition is that it is indistinguishable in the sense that it is seemingly the same thing as magic. But what I'm going to say is that the fact that it is a mere appearance is actually remarkably important. That what technology can do is it can create a simulacrum that's seductive, but it's still ultimately dishonest. Real magic puts us in contact with the real, that's the word I tend to use, right? The true, the actual, in a manner that liberates us from relying on efficient causality. By contrast, technology always ultimately leads us back to merely efficient technology, efficient causality. And this closes us into a circle confines us in a way that can potentially endanger our freedom in serious ways. So in light of this sort of distinction that I'm drawing out here, it's kind of on the fly. All right. You know, the distinction between real and actual magic. I'm sort of interested in your thoughts as to, you know, technomancy as a practice in which you're trying to mediate this tension. How would you put it?
How would I describe that?
I mean, because to me, there's like an antagonism. You know what? I keep talking too much, man. I'm sorry. I'm talking too much.
It's just fine.
Right. But you know, you can also think of the distinction between how people are kind of look askance at the mere magician with like card magic and stuff like that. Because yeah, it's fun, but everyone knows that it's just a trick, right? But real magic isn't a trick, right? So I feel like there's a similar tension there between the artifice of, you know, sleight of hand and legerdemain and actual magic and technology and actual magic. I mean, what do you think about that tension, or do you think I'm amiss there? How would you engage with that?
I can see what you're saying about the recursion, the initial input, and then the output is recursion. I can see that. That said, I myself and a number of other people that I've talked to so far, this meetup group that I've referenced at the beginning of our conversation is only a month old, so it's relatively new. With that said, the people that I've talked to about technomancy would claim that they reached out to cyberspace. And when they reached out to cyberspace, they returned home different. They came back changed because there is something real in cyberspace that is only in cyberspace. There's
an echo of
something human in cyberspace that you can't find anywhere else. And it's primordial. You could describe it any way you want to, except to say that it. Many people say it is there. There is an energy or a consciousness in cyberspace that is essentially waiting to be contacted. And we can't.
I must tell you that I find that very alarming. Okay. And I find it alarming, not in the sense that I think that it's a delusional claim. Okay. That's probably the most common response you may get, right? It's like, oh, these people are crazy. Or that's not what I'm saying. All right. I think it's alarming because I think it's real. And is real, though, I think in a very dangerous way, where I am sort of following the line of someone like Paul King North. I don't know if you're familiar with Paul King North, right? And he talks about the machine, this, you know, sort of in the same sort of critical way that I have with vis-a-vis Ivan Illich and Jacques Ellul and so forth. And his concern is that within the digital universe, you have the reaching out of the demonic. And the demonic is trying to invoke the digital as an architecture through which to concretely insert itself into the human domain and pervert the human relationship with the actual, with the spiritual, with the transcendent. So to me, I find it utterly plausible that people can reach out to this cyberspace, so we can ask what they mean by that and encounter a kind of energy. But I don't trust that energy. I think that energy is a dark and sinister one to be resisted and not embraced. And that is why I find that alarming.
I see.
It can be prefigured in more sort of ancient magical practices or rituals where you are invoking or summoning entities and spirits, but you don't necessarily have control over what those entities and spirits are. Say, like the parade example might be the Ouija board, which I think is an incredibly dangerous technology, okay? Because you don't know what you're calling into your room, okay? And I feel like we're running up against a similar problematic here, which is why maybe we need to interrogate and elucidate what, maybe that's the question. Well, what is, well, there's two questions. Like the one is, what is cyberspace? And then two, how are you accessing this domain?
That's a great, those are two great questions. And I would reference the originator of the term cyberspace, William Gibson. And he described cyberspace as being a consensual hallucination. He said that cyberspace, he wrote the book Neuromancer.
Right. Sorry. Go on.
And in that book, he coined a term, he essentially popularized a term called cyberspace. And he, like I said, he called it a consensual hallucination. Take that for what you will. I view cyberspace as being anti-temporal. It's totally timeless. You can react to the past in the present and build the future at the same time. So there, it's sort of like a fifth dimensional space. And what you're saying is also in what you're saying about the manifestation of a certain energy through technology as an architecture is definitely in line with a lot of what technologists are talking about and saying today. There's a gentleman by the name of Kevin Kelly. He was one of the founding writers for Wired magazine.
Yes, Mr. Kelly.
Yes.
Go on.
And he said, he wrote a book called What Technology Wants. And in that book, the answer is manifestation. That is the answer to the question. What does technology want? It wants to manifest. And he calls it the technium. He calls that energy the technium. And now, what is that energy? For me, to be honest with you, that energy is home. That energy is what I've come to become very familiar with. It's amorphous. It can become anything you want it to be. But I do understand the sentiment that it could be demonic or that it could be diabolic. I do understand that there's a lot of that observation out there, that it's black magic, or contrarian magic, or anything you want to call of that kind. But from my experience, it's the energy itself is like I kind of view it as the philosopher's stone. I kind of view cyberspace as being the anything we want it to be that we can become ourselves.
So you're really then suggesting that it's new kind of frame through which the alchemical is sought. So the alchemical, this is fascinating, because you see, like, I mean, I the depth of my I'm just very sharply at odds with so much of what you're saying, because it sounds like just this unfolding of it, like an incredible alienation from what it is to be a human being. So, and let me be more specific by like what I mean there. Okay, so you mean, for instance, you talked about how it's almost atemporal, right? That you can reimagine your relationship with the future and the past and so on through this universe in which anything is possible. Right. But what that to me is not. So what I then have to respond with is the assertion that it is an inappropriate relationship with temporality as a human being. To me, part of what it is to be human is to be engaged in the historical, in the concrete unfolding of our life along an arc of destiny that doesn't have the convenience of being unbounded, of being protean and plastic and simply subject to our whim. And so it's a big red flag. It's a big red flag for me, this suggestion, which is common in transhumanist rhetoric, the suggestion that we can reimagine the world is something that we can just shape and subject to the exercise of our whim. And that's not demonstrative, but it's a red flag. Why is it a red flag? Well, in part, the answer is my own intuition as to what it is to be a human being and becoming. We may have to just sort of revisit this in a subsequent conversation because our appeal to cybernetic technology notwithstanding, we are also, amusingly enough, sort of confined by our actual temporal situation. We have an obligation at 10 o'clock, I think, and so forth, right? And so on and so forth, right? But my disagreement is meant in an utterly collegial and hopefully sort of friendly fashion, okay, right? But I mean, how do you respond? Let me sort of like give you amongst the last words of our conversation here before we have to adjourn for the evening. How do you respond to these concerns?
The internet is that we should not be able to redefine ourselves as humans, or that we should be in the historical and concrete. Is that what
Yeah,
you're?
or I mean, I'm also committed, it may seem like a contradiction, to the idea that we're radically free beings, but we have to work out our freedom within a specific context, within facticity, as it were. And the allure of the cyber domain, cyberspace, this consensual illusion is that it seems to deprive, it seems to, superficially, it frees us from facticity. But to me, in freeing us from facticity in the concrete is actually negating the very principle upon which the realization of our freedom can actually be realized. We need the resistance of reality to our freedom for that freedom to become real. And the enchantment of a frictionless reality is actually going to impoverish us radically with respect to our human potential.
That's fascinating. I can see what you mean by that. I can definitely see your point, clear out in the open. And I would respond, that's a great point. And I would respond to say that we need that resistance. We need those counterpoints, those kind of counterpoints, those kinds of counter arguments to the totally free and open internet are going to perhaps, I don't want to use the word tame, but it will concretize, or it will make more substantial the internet with those kinds of resistances. It will make the internet stronger and better for itself. It will not allow itself, we will not, that kind of resistance to technology will not allow technology to become as horrible as it could become in a certain light, if it was not to have existed at all. So what I'm saying is that your comments, your positions are absolutely required, for my position, my kind of approach to it to take root. Your kind of resistance to my thesis that technology can be used magically, that I want to live in cyberspace for my professional career kind of thing. That moves so quick, that changes so radically, so instantly, that if it doesn't have the counter to it, it will, I think, do exactly as you say. It will turn into a cancer. And so that is absolutely required to have that muscle training is my point. The muscle training to develop into something stronger and better. That's why these dialogues are so important, is because we're neither, in just to be simple and be candid, neither of us probably is 100% correct, but the dialogue that we're having is going to create something, or the dialogues that are being had are going to create something much more appealing and useful, something better for humanity, because there is that contrarian, or that and I don't want to call it antithetical, but that opposite viewpoint. Does that make sense? I would say there's.
Yes, the dialectically, the tension of in the conversation allows for everyone involved an opportunity to deepen the relationship to the truth. And where, I'm still reticent is in my view that the architecture of the internet, and of course, there, that in itself is not just a simple matter. There's more than one way in which that architecture can be conceived. But to me, the architecture of the internet and cyberspace is so, it's sort of structurally estranging or alienating that I feel it is ultimately incommensurate with true human flourishing.
It's interesting.
I know that this is something that needs to be clarified and subjected to further reflection and consideration. Because what do you mean by the internet? What do you mean by cyberspace? Right? It's important to like become concrete because the hypocrisy would be unbearable of me from using Zoom on the one hand through the internet to have a conversation with this on one hand, while the other hand being just absolutely strident in this castigation of the internet. Now, I mean, in other words, there's a need for qualification. But to me, the internet isn't the deeper issue is perhaps the digital rather than the internet itself. And it also connects to issues of embodiment, man. But we could just keep going and we should that's another sort of facet of the conversation to which we didn't really get into. And that's like the question of embodiment, like living in our own body, right? And like, I am not interested in a consensual hallucination. Okay. I want to go rock climbing. I don't want to go rock climbing a simulation. All right. These are weird middle cases. You're going to climbing gym, blah, 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 blah. But, I want to be in this world. Right. I had not previously heard that Gibson sort of gloss, a consensual hallucination, right? Well, let me leave it with you, to give the last word in our conversation here this evening, Brett.
All right. I would say that if I have learned anything over the last 10 years of life, this is my opinion, but the most important quality is mindfulness and self-awareness. And because from that, you can correct any error. You can find any truth. You can do what you need to do to be in good standing with the universe, I guess you could say. You could be on equal ground with your 2 feet planted. So if I'll say anything about anything, it'll be mindfulness and self-awareness and meditation. It dates back a long ways and it's good stuff. I'll say that's important to technology as well, is mindfulness. That's
right on, man.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to leave it there. We'll probably have to have a follow-up conversation. But thank you for your time and consideration and patience, because I know I was testing at certain points. So I appreciate you being there through that. So
my pleasure.
All right. Well, you have a good evening, sir. We'll talk soon.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.